I'd like to introduce our speaker chairperson, Patrick.
Hi, I'm Patrick. Our speaker tonight and I go back, 17 years? And it was through a professional association that we belong to. And here about a month and 6 weeks ago, I heard her speak at a Sunday morning meeting. And, you know, I want what she has, and ask her if she would be gracious enough to share her experience, strength, and hope with us. And she said yes. So please help me welcome Sharon.
And I'd like to thank Patrick for asking me to be here tonight. I'm Sharon. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet all of you. I'm a little off my game tonight. I spent the day in the emergency room, and I just, at about 5:45, got out of the ICU. I was there with my 88-year-old uncle. And, you know, the whole time I was there, I was thinking, I'm going to call Pat and Bale. I'm going to call Pat and Bale. But I didn't have his number with me, of course. And then the ICU is closed now. I can't be there anyway. And I thought, what better place to be than at a meeting? And it's funny. You know, this is, my uncle is one of the alcoholics in my life. And the whole time I was growing up, he was a nasty, mean drunk. And I would have wished him dead 1,000 times already, you know. And a little over a year and a half ago, I have a sister who has Down syndrome. And once a year, a group she goes to walks in the LA Marathon, and she's like a little heat-seeking missile looking for sponsors to that marathon. And she would always call this uncle, and he would send her a check. And for years, like clockwork, she'd make the call, he'd send the check. And in 2006, the check didn't come. So I called him, not concerned about the money, but concerned about the break in our pattern there. And he said, oh, some characters have been borrowing money from me, and they haven't paid me back, so I can't afford to send her any this year. Now, I'd been calling him, checking in with him. He'd say he was fine. And so after I heard this, I called Adult Protective Services. And they said, oh, we get calls on your uncle all the time. And it turned out that three drug addicts had moved in with him, were beating him up, were having him write checks, and essentially they were passing him from person to person so that during the night he would be taken out to the Versateller two or three times a night to get money. When a bank would catch on that they were stealing from him, they would move him to another bank. And so when I found out this was going on, I went to see what was happening. And when I saw the filth that these amphetamine addicts had created in his apartment, he was filthy. It was a nightmare. And because of this program, I could look at the disease and not hate those people. I wanted to hate them, but they're sick people. And under the right circumstances, that could have been me, you know? So I literally had to kidnap him because he wanted to stay there. I had to take him filthy. He had blood caked on him. He was filthy. I marched him on a plane. I hid him in a motel, marched him onto a plane. He arrived here in California with just the clothes on his back, and the flight attendants had said, sir, why don't you keep that blanket? And that was it. That was what he got here with. And we started to build this life together. He doesn't drink anymore. And he is actually a really nice guy now. And he even said to me about a year ago how some people, when they drink, get really nasty. And I was able to say, I know, you used to be like that. And I could say it without hating him. I could say it not from a I'll get you place, but just from a fact place. You used to be like that. And there has been so much healing going on with him and me over the past year and a half. And there's also been a lot of, you know, police involvement, adult protective service. It's been a nightmare. I have to say, it has truly been a nightmare. I have never seen anything like this. I could never have imagined anything like this. And yet, it has a happy ending, you know. And today, when I went over to visit him, they said his blood pressure was low and his color was bad. And I could take him over to the emergency room. He was down, two-thirds of his blood was gone. And they said if we hadn't gotten him in there today, he would have either had a heart attack or brain damage from lack of oxygen. So I'm kind of not in a good place right now. And that's just where it is for me. And I am so grateful to have the opportunity to have him in my life and to have the healing that we've been able to put together. My childhood was riddled with alcoholism. I was powerless over alcohol from birth. One of the stories my mother would always tell was how a neighbor had to drive her to the hospital when she was in labor because my father was out at a bar. So from birth, I was powerless over alcohol. And we were the alcoholic family. My father, all his sisters, his brother, all of them were all alcoholics. And at one point, when things were still kind of good, you know, there was a phase, I'd say from like up till 5, it wasn't that bad. And he was working. And so it was kind of okay. And we moved. I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey. We moved out to the suburbs. You know, we moved to the suburbs. And we were the family in the suburbs. We were the house at the end of the block that had the big potholes in the driveway, that had the shutter that was falling down, that had the garage door with broken windows, that had the grass that was up to your knees, that had the paint peeling off the walls, that when you got inside had holes in the wall from where things had been punched through it. And even though we lived in the suburbs, we had our little alcoholic slum all established, all on our own. And my father always had the alcoholic car that you could hear coming three blocks away. So embarrassment was a big part of my childhood. And I hate, to this day, I hate being embarrassed. I will go to any length to not be embarrassed. And it just was really, really difficult. I can remember watching other girls with their dads, and it would make me want to cry seeing a daughter walking with holding her dad's hand. And I was in a meeting. This was last week. And there was a dad who had, I'd say the girl was about 10, 9 or 10, and she was sitting on her dad's lap. And it looked so safe, and it looked so good. And it reminded me how my dad used to have me in the car going through Newark, New Jersey. I don't know if you know about Newark, New Jersey, but there's some bad spots in Newark, New Jersey. And my dad knew the bars and the bad spots. And he would park the car, and he would say, "Don't let anybody in. This is a very dangerous neighborhood. I'll be right out." So it's dark. I'm in the car by myself. I'm curled up on the floor, hoping he'll come right out and knowing that once he starts drinking, he's not coming right out. And I just saw that little girl sitting there safe, and I thought about me in the back of that car. And, you know, that kind of stuff just really just breaks my heart. You know, it just breaks my heart. And I came to Al-Anon because I was so angry. I was just, you know, the very first meeting I went to was when my older brother got sober. He got put into a recovery program, and I took my mother to an Al-Anon meeting in New Jersey, and I thought, a lot of good this is going to do. I couldn't see it. I couldn't feel it. It just was like, this is supposed to help, listening to this stuff. So I didn't think much of Al-Anon. And when my ex-husband was in recovery, and I was arguing with him nonstop all the time, and he wasn't even there. The argument was in my head, and it was endless. And I was reaching a point where I couldn't stand it anymore. And out of desperation, I thought, well, I'll try an Al-Anon meeting. And I went to this really, really great Al-Anon meeting. And everybody just was so into recovery. And I'm just going to back up a little bit here, because about 26 years ago, I did go to some ACA meetings. And the first ACA meeting I went to, I laughed out loud through the whole thing. Everything they said, all the horror stories, everything, I was just laughing out loud. And when they said, would any newcomers like to share, I had to put my hand up and I said, you know, I'm sorry I was laughing, but if I didn't laugh, I was just going to sob through this whole meeting. So that was my ACA experience, and I went to meetings for a while. And, you know, it was all about the inner child and helping the inner child. But I needed help for my inner adult. You know, I really needed to get in touch with my inner adult and do something there. So years and years later, I'm in this Al-Anon meeting. I'm hearing all of this great recovery. And when they asked for the newcomers who wanted to share, I put my hand up and I said, you know, all I can do is give you a 3-minute message from the disease. I don't get this. And I kept going back to that meeting, and I started to hear things. And I went in there an angry, angry woman. And before long, I was just a hurt child. And Al-Anon held me till I had enough strength to get in touch with that adult. You know, Al-Anon had to carry me. And I've had a tremendous amount of trouble with the steps. The first step I have to go over again and again and again, because I will not admit I am powerless over anything. I will keep hammering and pounding and try to get it to work and try to get it to work and try to get it to work. I spent my life being like this round peg that I have tried to hammer into a square hole my whole life. And Al-Anon has taught me to just be who I am and to be okay being who I am. But this business, I'm a fixer. I will work nonstop at, you know, I mean, I am like lock her up before she strikes again, crazy with trying to fix people. And it's like sad for me. It's really sad for me. And I, thanks to Al-Anon, there's hope, you know, there's actually hope. So with this first step, I took my first step, and I was writing down all of the things that I was powerless over. and really getting how unmanageable my life was. But I had to take it a little bit further because I had to look at all of the things that I do to manage the unmanageable once I admit in my heart of hearts that it's unmanageable. Can you follow that? So once I know that there is absolutely nothing I can do about this, I'm powerless, I can do nothing, I will start to suffer. I will get depressed. I will get angry. I will do anything rather than go into acceptance because I am going to get it right, you know. I have spent most of my life trying to heal my past. When my mother died, I didn't even grieve my mother, her death, because I was so busy, one, still trying to make her life better, you know. Go figure that one. How are you going to do that? But doesn't stop me. Then after I figured out, well, I can't make her life better. She's dead now, you know. I went into grieving her life because I couldn't even get to the point of grieving her death yet, you know, because alcoholism, I watched it destroy my mother. You know, I watched it destroy my mother. And that's not, you know, we just didn't do anything about it. When I got to Al-Anon and they said, keep your hands in your pockets and don't catch the alcoholic, I couldn't even fathom that. Because if you don't catch them, there's going to be all these problems, you know, there's just going to be all these problems. And I came to realize that if only we hadn't worked so hard in my family to look good, hadn't worked so hard to make it be okay, hadn't worked so hard to make it right, maybe if it had fallen apart, we could have gotten help. We could have healed as a family. You know, as it was, I was the first one to break away to do any kind of 12-step work and get some help. And then my brother got some, but that was it. You know, I have a younger brother who died of his disease. He rode the cocaine train out. After that, my mother went into a clinical depression. And just, you know, crazy things that this disease does. And so, you know, I come to Al-Anon. I'm going to the meetings. I'm not getting the first step. I am starting, when I did that list of how I try to manage the unmanageable, I started to see what my insanity was. You know, I made a list of my insanity. And until I got down to those things that I do, I didn't really get the depth of my insanity. And, you know, an example, and I think this is, I had a job a while back, maybe 5 years ago, and it was just a very short time that I was there, and I hated this job. The first day I left, I sobbed all the way home. The second day, I sobbed all the way home. The first week, I sobbed all the way home. And when I stopped crying, I got really worried. It just scared me when I stopped crying and I was at this job. And friends kept going, you got to get out of there, you got to get out of there, you got to get out of there. And I couldn't get out. I couldn't bring myself to tell them I wanted out. I was afraid they weren't going to like me. I was afraid they were going to think I was a bad person. So I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker so I can look good. That's like the family motto, you know, be as sick as you need to be to look good. And that's like, that's what I was doing. And so a friend of mine says, Sharon, just write your letter of resignation. Just write it. You don't have to turn it in, just write it. So I write it, and I write a very simple letter that says, I'm sorry, I'm unable to do this job at this time, and I'm giving you 2 weeks' notice. And I call my friend and I read it, and she says, Sharon, do you believe you can't do this job? Do you really believe it? And I said, well, no, because if I put in more time and if I did this and this and this, I could do the job. And she said, do you want to do that? And I said, no, I don't want to do that. Then she said, then do you understand you can't do the job? And I said, no, I could do this job. You know, if they gave me an assistant and if I had some help with it. And she said, do you want to do that? And I said, no. And she said, well, then do you understand that you can't do this job? And again, I said, no, if I just did da-da-da-da. And we did this at least 6 times with me going back and saying, if I did da-da-da-da-da-da, I could do it. And her saying, do you want to do that? And can you do this job? And finally, I said, I understand. I get it. I don't want to twist myself in all of those different directions. I don't want to fold myself up into some origami bird. It's not right. It's not right for me, and I have to leave. Now, in my family, I learned to hang in, and I learned to do what you need to do. You know, my mother would tell us, never ask for help. Do not ask for help, because she was so embarrassed and felt so bad about our situation that she thought if we asked for help, it would make us look bad. So just as an example, to get to town from where I lived was a 3-mile walk. If the neighbors were going out to town, I was not allowed to say, can I go with you? Because then it would mean that there was no one there to drive me and we would look bad, so we couldn't look bad. So I would have to, if I was out on the street walking and a neighbor stopped and said, would you like a ride? I could say yes, but I was never allowed to ask for help. I was also at my younger brother's funeral. My mother said, don't cry. Do not cry. I don't want people to see you crying. Now, that was her disease. That was her Al-Anon disease. And I did not realize, you know, I spent my, I'm jumping around. I'm sorry. You have to, you know, I'll maybe tie it up, but we'll go to, I spent, you know, all right, forgot that one. All right, anyway. You know, over 50, it just is a, it's a crapshoot. Anyway, so it was, you know, like, right, her, when the first time, I was never going to go to therapy because I knew that I was not going to pay money to sit there and try to look good in front of somebody. I could do that for free. Why should I pay money to do that? So I reached a point in my life where I thought, okay, I can be honest now. I'll go to therapy. And all I did was complain about my alcoholic father and how he ruined my life and, you know, what a mess my life was. And if this AH hadn't ruined my life, I would have a great life. I mean, on and on. Blah, 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 blah. My father ruined, victim, victim, victim. All of this. And then one day the therapist says, Sharon, you never talk about your mother. And I said, my mother was a saint. We don't talk about my mother. Maybe a little problem there? Maybe? So when we started to talk about my mother and how my mother never expressed her anger, my mother would suck all the air out of the room and never open her mouth. It was like she had lockjaw and all the love was gone and we would all just wait till the love, till the, you know, the tide would come back in and there would be some love in the house again. And it just, it never occurred to me. And, you know, I don't blame my parents They were two people who had problems, and they were doing the best they can. And at a certain point, it became my responsibility to make my life better, you know, and to free them from my anger, free them from my resentment. And it took me a long time to be able to do that. And I'm so grateful that I found this program before my father died, so that I could love my father for who he was. And my father was a wet brain alcoholic. He was bad. I could love him for who he was. I could stop blaming him. I could love my mother for who she was, and I stopped needing her. All my life, I needed my mother. And when I understood that it was because my mother needed to be needed, if you can follow that, you know, I kept myself little so that I would always need her. And when I decided that it would be okay to get big, I remember when I had my first job that was like a real job, and I brought my paycheck home, and my mother said, "Oh, you're making more than I do." And I felt horrible. I felt this big, and I felt like I had betrayed the family. Not a good feeling, not a good way to go through things. And you know, in Al-Anon, I've learned to do this living amends, you know, by making my life a good place. That's the best amends I can give to my family. And by making me, you know, I was not a safe place. I started with, I would go into silence. I would suck all the air out of the room. I would pout. I would never let you know what was going on. When you would say to me, "Sharon, are you mad?" I'd say, "No, I'm fine." And you were going to get it. You were going to get it. And a lot of the way I dealt with "you were going to get it" was, "I'll show you all really hurt me this time." And I can remember I was at a workshop one time, and someone, the person doing the workshop said, "Well, what things do you use to try to manipulate people and get your own way?" And all these people are yelling things out, and I yelled out, "I suffer." And she said, "Wait." She said, "I heard someone say, they suffer. Could you stand up?" And I stood up, and she said, "You know, well, how is that working for you?" I said, "Well, you know, it hasn't worked in 40 years, but I have hope." And it was like, I didn't realize that I was addicted to suffering. That was one of my tools. That was one of the main tools in my toolbox. And I, you know, my ex-husband never caught on that I was suffering to get him to change. My parents never caught on that I was suffering to get them to change. God never caught on that I was suffering to get, you know, like, let's move it a little bit here. And I have to say, I am so grateful to God for never giving me what I wanted because I was suffering. Because then I would believe that suffering worked, and I would spend the rest of my life suffering to try to get what I want. And so I'm grateful in that respect that suffering doesn't work. So if you're someone who likes to suffer, maybe you could share on my experience. It doesn't work. It never will. Hasn't, won't. 40 years of hope, that lousy, stinking hope, and it's, you know, and yet I will still go back to it. You know, people, I listen to people who say, I wish I knew then what I know now, if I could go back. I know what I know now, and I still do the same stuff. So I have no illusion about going back and making it better. I can only, right in this moment, try to stay present, because I run away. I can be standing right here in front of you and I'm gone. Or I'm standing behind myself, like kind of manipulating me to get you to think I'm okay. And I've had to stop all of that stuff. I've had to actually enter my body, you know, and be present in it and participate in life wearing it rather than being like always on the outside looking around. Again, I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, it's what I and I can still do it. I was going to say it's what I used to do, but I can still find myself in that spot of doing that. So I have my list. I go down and into the insanity. It became clear about my insanity. You know, that definition of doing the same thing over again, expecting different results, was very true for me. And the other one of expecting things from people that they cannot give me. I kept waiting for my parents to do it right. I kept wishing they would do it right. And I kept believing that if it wasn't coming from them, I didn't deserve love, I didn't deserve care, I didn't deserve fill in the blank. If I didn't get it from them, I didn't deserve it. And in Al-Anon, I learned that I deserve it. I learned I deserve to be loved. I deserve to be taken care of. I deserve to take care of myself. That was another thing. I would never take care of myself. I would be so busy taking care of other people. And I had this lesson, my dog lesson. As I said, I'm a major fixer. And I was walking home one day, and I see this dog on the street that's just a mangy mess. I mean, it was awful. It was sick. And at the time, I was living with a relative, and they had a dog. And I knew that if I took this dog home, I would have to call the pound, and the pound would have just put it to sleep. It would have just put the dog to sleep because it was too sick. I know that would have happened. And it took every ounce of strength in me to just walk past the dog because I wanted to fix that dog. And I let the dog be. And for, you know, days and days, I'm like guilty over how could you leave that dog? How could you leave that dog? Guilt is a medium I'm very familiar with. It's one of the colors on my palette that I will pull out at any given minute and paint a room with it. And like a few days later, I'm going past a yard and there's that dog and it's looking healthy. And the mange on it is healing. And by me having the good sense to leave the dog alone, somebody who could actually help it came in and did it. You know, the dog was getting the help it needed. And it suddenly occurred to me that with the alcoholics, if I took care of myself and left them alone, maybe the people who could really help them could do that job. Maybe their higher power could direct them to where they needed to be. It seems like a little event, you know. Okay, so you saw a mangy dog on the street and you walked by, so what? To me, it was monumental. It was such a life-changing event because I was constitutionally incapable of walking past that dog. I would have killed it with my love. That's what I would have done. I would have killed it with my love. And so I have had to again and again learn these lessons of just simple things that happen. And then I can take the feelings or I can take whatever it is into an Al-Anon meeting and I can discuss it or share about it or talk to a sponsor about it and I can learn and I can heal and I can grow. My sister is fabulous. She's fabulous. And I have been horrible to her my whole life. Not horrible, horrible like horrible, but I have been horrible. I have tried to get her to be normal since I was 7 years old. You know, there's a seven-year-old driving the bus, and the tools that I have to work with her are the tools of a seven-year-old child. And it was always kind of in the family that when my parents were dead, my sister would come and live with me. Now, I never took care of myself, so how could I take care of another person with special needs? And the 12 steps taught me how to grow up, how to be an adult, and created a safe place in me. And when my sister came out here, I knew enough to get some help. And I was at a meeting, and I was sharing about how frightened I was that my sister was coming out here to live with me because of that fact that I didn't know how to take care of myself. And these two people came up to me and said, oh, call this number and tell them so-and-so and so-and-so sent you. And I follow direction. You know, I've learned in the program to follow direction. So I call that number, and it's a program for developmentally disabled adults. And my sister arrived here in July. I called them at the end of July, and the woman said, we're full right now. Call back in October. And I said, okay. Oh, but I forgot to mention that so-and-so and so-and-so said to call. And she said, bring your sister this Saturday. We have a meeting. And those people loved my sister and helped her. You know, she had to leave her whole life behind her. All her friends were in New Jersey. She had to come out here to start a new life. And they had an instant place for her to be where there were friends for her. And there were parents there for me. And I, you know, as a sibling, I was always out in the trenches fighting. If a kid laughed at her, I'd have to deal with them. If she was having a problem, I had to deal with it. It's very different being a parent, as you well know. As a parent, you don't get to walk over and punch somebody. You don't get to, you know, deal with, let's you and me deal with this kind of thing. And these parents embraced me and taught me how to be a parent of a sibling, you know. And I became close to these parents, and some of the moms have a little group, and they call it the Mommy and Me group. And I'm the me, because I'm not a mommy. And without, I can't ask for help. I was raised to not ask for help. I was raised that to seek help was wrong. And by coming to this program, I learned how to put my hand out, and I learned how to say, I can't do this by myself. And I hear people in meetings all the time saying, well, God never gives you any more than you can handle. And I want to tell you my experience is that God gave me plenty more than I could ever handle. And it forced me to get outside myself and ask other people for help. And having it went against every grain, every fiber of my being to be able to do that. And it's only in these rooms that I have learned that I can do that. An example, you know, intimacy is a big word. And I'm a hiker. And I was out hiking with a friend of mine one day, and, you know, I have 10 years of ballet experience, so when it comes to rock hopping, I'm fabulous. I can do it. You want to see a good rock hopper? It's me. I'm out in the middle of the stream, and I'm on this rock, and I freeze up, And the rock wasn't that far. In my head, I knew I could do it, but I just froze in the middle of this stream. And he goes, "What's up?" And instead of saying, "Well, I'm just enjoying the negative ions here," I said, "I'm afraid. I know intellectually I could make this jump, but I'm afraid." And he said, "Well, I'll get on this rock and you take my hand and I'll help you." And I said, "I can't do that because I'll pull you in." And he said, "That's okay. It just means that we'll do the rest of the hike with wet boots. It's no big deal." So he took my hand, and of course I just jumped over. I scampered over. And I couldn't understand what happened, but there was like this big shift in my head, like this, "Oh my God, what was that?" So I called one of my cousins and I laid out simple, nothing event, right? I mean, big deal. You're stuck in the middle of the creek. You take a guy's hand, you jump, done. And she said to me, "Sharon, do you realize that if you did that to any member of your family, they would have gotten out first. They would have made fun of you for being afraid on the rock. Then they'd have gotten out and put their hand out, and when you took it, they'd have pulled you in. And then they'd have ridiculed you for having wet pants. Do you see how this could be a big deal, that you trusted someone enough to put your hand out and tell them how you were feeling? And I don't see those things in the moment. I could feel that something..." And again, you could say, "That's not a big deal." To me, that being able to trust that someone would help me and then they followed through and did was amazing to me, because I had a lifetime of things that didn't work out, things that fell through, being made fun of, being laughed at, and I have learned in this program who's safe to reach out to and who's not safe. And honestly, I would reach out to the not safe people. You know, till I got recovery, I would know the difference and I would go for the not safe people, because that's what I understood. And I had to come to these rooms to learn, to look for the safe people, to put my hand out to the safe people. And, you know, I have a problem. My mind goes and goes and goes and goes. And I, you know, if I'm thinking, I'm only thinking in one of three categories. It's either poor me, where's mine, or fuck you. And I just, I will run those over and over and over again. And I have to stay close to these rooms. I have to talk to my sponsor. I have to be close to my friends. And, you know, I know it's real easy to fall away, to feel like I'm okay. You know, I'm feeling good now. And as long as I have the capacity to think, I need to be here. And I need the steps, and I need the fellowship, and I need the sponsoring, because left to my own devices, I will gravitate towards what's unhealthy. Even knowing better, I will gravitate towards the problem. I will gravitate towards there's something wrong with me. I will gravitate towards I'm not enough, towards life is unfair. And I am so grateful that, you know, right now, and I'm 2 minutes left, I'm not working right now. I'm doing a part-time job. And I didn't realize that I had put in my, when I left my job, I thought, I never told people what I did. I never was like, "Oh, well, I'm a so-and-so, so, you know." I never told people that. So why do I feel bad leaving this job? And it was in my head. I used the job to make me be okay. And I used that I had a little savings account to make me be okay. Well, I'm burning through that, and I don't have the job, and I have nothing in my head to to make me be okay. I can't think I'm okay. So I have had to just become okay, you know? And again, it's a little simple switchover. I didn't know I was only okay in my head till all my sparkles were taken away. My, you know, the stuff was taken away. And the only thing that's left in my head now is program. And I'm okay. Thanks.